The J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. Sam, I think a lot of us were still in shock after last Thursday's top of the table clash. But yeah, we shook off the cobwebs over the weekend. Another action-packed J1 match day.
Yeah, just about shook them up, and then Vigalta Sendai went and won at home. So, yeah, shocks were still going on Saturday. But we've had a good start to the Golden Week. How's it been for you? Yeah, just getting started.
Well, yeah, unfortunately not as prepared as I would have liked to have been for this episode, but that's Golden Week for you. I would have liked to have had a bit of quiet time at work today, actually, to get a bit more prepared. But, that's what happens when you've got two littlies running around. But yeah, we're very excited to be joined on this episode by Alan Gibson to talk about all things Kansai in J1. Alan, welcome back to the pod. How are you?
Thank you. I'm excited too.
Well, that's absolutely fantastic. I'm very glad to hear that, Alan. And so it was a very exciting match day. And for Vissel Kobe, some would say a long overdue victory. They'd drawn their previous three games in the top flight, but they hosted Hiroshima on Saturday, Alan, and this game was pretty much put to bed inside the first half hour.
Oh, wasn't it fun? That Mr. Furuhashi's a great player, isn't he? I guess most people want to talk about the fact that Andres Iniesta came back eventually, but and I was quite concerned that Vissel were doing reasonably well without, without their foreign players. Just one defeat all season, and that was against Nagoya, so debatable. And I think that Vissel have been growing quite nicely into the fact that they didn't have Vermaelen or Iniesta or Douglas even. And then suddenly, when all the Japanese guys are exciting and playing together, in come two new foreign players, and it's all going to go to pot, or is it? Because it all went together by itself, didn't it? It was excellent, excellent game on, Saturday? It was rather good in the end. So, Furuhashi, two lovely finishes, some very nice touches, lots of chances and half chances created. And the fact is that, I mean, they're playing the youngsters as often as they can. So it's really quite good. Obviously, Kikuchi's established himself at centre-back, hasn't he? He's quite a beast. But Daiju Sasaki, Ino Ueshion from J2 last year, is a surprise that he's played so often. And this game, they started with Nakasaka, Yuya Nakasaka up front as well. So they're definitely not relying on the big names or the foreigners. So it was quite a pleasure to see.
Indeed. So, yes, Sam, there was a warning sign for Hiroshima in the ninth minute when Sergi Samper played a long ball forward for Kyogo Furuhashi, but he pulled his shot wide at the near post. But then just 2 minutes later, another long ball over the top, this time from Hotaru Yamaguchi, found Furuhashi in stride. And, at the second time of asking, he made no mistake with a brilliant dinked finish.
Yeah, terrific finish. And as you were saying there, the balls were going over the top. It's like a new way of playing for Kobe this season, where they get the ball and their first thought is to look over the top or through to Furuhashi, and it's just a lot quicker, it's a lot more dynamic, and they're getting goals out of it, and Furuhashi is thriving in that centre-forward position. I mean, yeah, the finishes in this game were terrific from him. He's becoming an even better player than we already knew he was. And, yeah, it is really good to see. And I share Alan's maybe concerns that once the foreign players come in, does this way of playing change? Do they go back to the way they've been playing the last couple of years? But for now, it's a vibrant, youthful Kobe side, and they're a joy to watch.
You hit the nail on the head there, didn't you? Because, you know, Iniesta came on for about 15 minutes, and suddenly there was lots of passing and not a lot going on. I think that's probably a bit cruel on Iniesta, and he did certainly look as if he wanted to be there and he enjoyed himself. But as I said, yeah, I mean, will Vissel stick with the long balls and the quick balls, and or will they go back to what they were, unpenetrative and basically a bit too slow to get the ball up front? It was great to see, as you said. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next game.
Do you think there'll be pressure from above on Miura to bring in these new foreign players to play Iniesta all the time? Do you think he will be forced back into that kind of barsification as they've been trying to do? Or do you think, given the way they've played this season, a bit of faith might be shown in the way they've been playing?
I think I feel, or I hope that Mr. Mikitani is sort of leaving it to Mr. Mura now, because Mura was basically the head of the scouting and the general manager, for want of a better word, for a couple of years at least, and then was thrown into the coaching job while they've looked for someone else, and then either that someone else didn't come or they decided that Mura did okay, and now he's either stuck with the job or he's got the job, and he's probably got the okay from above, because I think I get the feeling that Mura is one of Mikitani's choices, and not necessarily to become the manager, but now he's become the manager, I think he's being left to it. I think it's interesting that there are so many young players being given the chance, and players like Hatsuse, who was basically, I mean, he wasn't really going anywhere last season, and I wasn't expecting him to play much this season, has actually started a few games and come on as substitute. He even started up left wing a couple of games back. And Masuyama, who came back from Avispa Fukuoka on loan, and again, I wasn't sure he was going to get any place really, but he's been given a chance a few times. And Ayub Masika, he likes to be called Masi or Masika apparently. Lincoln is already getting his chances. So I think we shall find out if these guys are actually good enough to take the places that are being given to Nakasaka and Inoue and Sasaki and Goke, who wasn't featured in this game. So there's plenty of youth being played, and it will be very interesting to see if they get shunted out for the foreign players or not. But I think there will be less pressure, at least while they're not losing. We didn't say they're necessarily winning many games yet, but while they're not losing, I get the feeling that Mura will be able to do pretty much what he wants and prove himself. And I also think that Iniesta, and it will be acceptable by Mr. Mikitani, that Iniesta won't necessarily play more than 50% or so of the games, because, you know, this will have proved that they can do things without him. So it'll be interesting to, you know, I think he might even end up being a super sub, which would be interesting. So we'll see. I don't think there's going to be pressure at the top while Vissel are not losing, shall we say that.
Yep, fair enough then. All right, well, yeah, it was good to see Iniesta back out on the pitch for the last 15 minutes, but obviously before then, Kobe had well and truly wrapped up the 3 points. So after Furuhashi put them ahead in the 11th minute, up the other end, Daya Maekawa was forced into a good save from Junior Santos' first-time shot. But then in the 25th minute, Sergi Sampur again played a through ball that sliced open the static Hiroshima defensive back line, and Furuhashi raced clear and finished clinically past Keisuke Osako for 2-0, and then 6 minutes later, so just past the half hour, from a Kobe corner, the ball was inadvertently diverted towards goal by a Hiroshima defender, and the previously mentioned young forward Yuya Nakasaka turned in from 3 yards out. So, yeah, it was pretty much game over after the half hour. In the second half, 8 minutes in, Maekawa denied Junior Santos again. Then, of course, Iniesta came on for his first Kobe appearance in 142 days, the DAZN commentator told us. And then with 8 minutes left, Furuhashi was denied a hat-trick by a Keisuke Osako save, and that was it. As I said, Kobe's first win in 4 games, but as Alan said, yeah, just the one loss this season in J1. And after the result of the next game we're going to chat about with Alan, Kobe are now the best placed of the Kansai teams, a fifth in the table. They have played 12 games, and, some teams above them have played as many as 13. So they do have a game in hand on some of the teams above them, and sitting pretty, we would say. They've obviously had to come from behind in a couple of games recently to snatch points, but this was, a very comfortable 3-0 victory. So before we move off this game, Sam, any words on Hiroshima? This was a particularly flat-looking display from them, and it's now 5 without a win for them. They still sit 8th, so comfortably mid-table, but this did appear to be an especially underwhelming performance from the Purples.
Yeah, they were really disappointing. I think They had a lot of issues at the back. It was quite a flat line, and they weren't dealing with Furuhashi's runs through. Maybe because Sho Sasaki was out, and maybe his presence at the back was kind of unsettling them. Yuta Imatsu came in, and then he was kind of at fault for the first goal. He didn't clear very well, and it just allowed Furuhashi in. And then it was him that the ball ricocheted off for Nakasaka for the third goal. So, yeah, they weren't as stable as they usually are at the back. And then I just think the quickness of the play from Kobe, they just didn't get to grips with it. Aoyama, I mean, 35 now in midfield, he doesn't necessarily snap into a tackle that quickly. And, yeah, they just were quite easily beaten in that midfield area. And I've said pretty much all season, I still think they're still adapting to this 4-3-3. I don't think they really know how to play it, and I don't think they've got the players in the right positions for it. So, yeah, they were just quite easily taken apart. And when you're 3-0 down after half an hour, I mean, it's going to be demoralising for any team, and really they didn't show much fight in terms of trying to get back into it.
All right then. So, yes, Kobe up to fifth in the table, and they are, as I said, now the highest placed Kansai team, one spot ahead of Cerezo Osaka, who drew 1-1 with Osaka rivals Gamba in Sunday's Osaka Derby. This was Sam's pick of the weekend slate, and once again, yeah, you picked a 1-1 draw, Sam, so at least there was a couple of goals for the punters who tuned in to your recommended game. But they saw some controversy, there's no doubt about that, and don't worry, listeners, we're definitely breaking out the jingle later on as we chat about this game. So, Alan, heading in, of course, Cerezo hadn't played for 2 weeks, they had their last weekend off. And, Gumba's struggles at the start of this season are well documented, obviously, after their hiatus, their COVID-enforced hiatus. And then, the fact that they'd scored, coming into this game, just one goal in 7 league games. So I guess it's easy to say in hindsight now, but what were your expectations heading into this game? I guess especially from a Gumba perspective when they were struggling so much to get their season up and running.
I figured that Gamba would raise their game for the derby, as they, you know, as any good team does against their derby opponents. Watching the game closely, it wasn't that bad. I was quite impressed with Yajima, who came back in, who worked hard and had a couple of chances. And but it's obvious to me, and I should be able to find someone to talk to, but I haven't. Really, shall we say, I haven't disturbed anyone at Gamba to talk about it because, the big break from COVID and the business, and then the ACL was cancelled. It's not the best time to call up your friend who happened to be the manager of Gamba and say, what's going on over there? So I've kept quiet. But it's obvious that there are players in Gamba that were out through COVID that haven't been named. And they just, you know, so they will be 2 or 3 weeks behind in the training. And then Leandro Pereira and Thiago Alves were also late coming in, and then they just about get to start the game, and then they're out for a month. It was literally a month, wasn't it, where Gamba didn't play. Mm. So I would say that with patience, Gamba will put it together, and unlike certain clubs in the league, the Gamba bosses do have patience. And, of course, they have the Mr. Gamba there, for want of a better title. So they'll be patient with Sunayasa Miyamoto as well. So I don't think the alarm bells will be ringing. Of course, they've also got three, four, five games in hand on lots of teams above them, but they will need to score goals. But they've only lost 3 games. Only lost 3. They've only played 8, I think, isn't it? But it's not as bad as it could be, and it's not as bad as it looks. And I think that players that last year, like Yuya Fukuda, finally came in for the whole game this time, and as a sub last game. Takao Ryo has not played much at all. Kim Yong-gong, centre-back, is out and disappeared completely. It might be because of the system that Gamba are playing. Sune is also playing interesting young players that I wouldn't have expected to play, possibly because of injuries and illness, and possibly because he wants to try things. Kurokawa Keisuke is playing left back, and they also had Yota Sato play one game, which was a big surprise to me. And I think it's just he's not sure, or he's not able to play his top team right now. And as for Thiago Alves, I thought he was one of the worst players to ever hit the J-League when he was playing for Sagan Tosu. So I'm not sure what he's doing at Gamba, but he certainly hasn't done anything to improve his situation with me so far either. So tough times ahead for Gamba, but tough times have already been passed, and I think the team should have patience. They have plenty of talent in the team, both young and experienced. And throwing in Patrick, who was presumably, well, I think they've been trying to write him off for the last two seasons, and he comes in and it might have been a penalty, but he dispatched it with aplomb, didn't he? And Patrick always gives 100%. You know, he plays with his heart on his sleeve. So I don't think there's any problem in the long run for Gamba. I don't think they're going to be stuck in the bottom three or four for long. But I'd like to hear what you guys think as a non-Gamba watcher. You know, I'm trying to say I'm not a Gamba fan, but everybody knows I am, right? So, Mr. Optimistic over here, but obviously because I wanted to be optimistic, and I've got friends and I'm a long-term fan. So what do you guys think?
Well, I was going to throw it back to you, actually. You mentioned Thiago Alves there, and Leandro Pereira came in. You've also got Wellington Silva coming into those attacking areas. Do you think that those three players just coming in have kind of complicated things a little bit too much? And because Gamba have played a 4-4-2, they've played 4-3-3. I don't really think that Miyamoto is settled on what is the best way to approach the attacking game with those players. Do you think they're... Do you see any signs of improvement in this game in terms of the way that they'd set up, or do you think he's still trying to get to grips with those players?
I think what was interesting, for want of a better word, is that Leandro Pereira has done very little to earn his place, I think, so far. But he was still given the opportunity to start the last two games, I think. So he's being kept faith with. Last year, I was surprised to see it, but Yuji Ono was playing very well for the first month or two of the season, and I wasn't expecting him to be in the team at all. And he was doing very well, and then he did his knee and he's out for 8 months. He'll also be back quite soon, I believe. He's in full training now. So there's some options coming in. I know nothing about Wellington Silva. Everybody's quite excited about him, apparently, but... really, I'll have to reserve judgment on that. But complicating things, I'm not sure. I mean, they started the season in the, for want of a better word, the Super Cup with Kawasaki up front. And I don't think he's quite ready to run the line, for want of a better word. There was also another kid, Dai Tsukamoto. We have Ichimi, Kazunari Ichimi, who came back from 2 years on loan at Yokohama FC and Kyoto Sanga. But I don't think any of them are what Leandro Pereira could be and should be. So I'm hoping that Leandro Pereira can get himself fit again and back in the team and score at least, you know, he said he was going to score more than 15 goals this year, but obviously there's been problems at Gamba. Even Shoji Toyama, who might have got a chance, but I wasn't expecting it this year, has now gone on loan to FC Ehime, or Ehime FC rather. So there's a lot going on at Gamba, and I think, yes, you're quite right in the fact that things have been complicated. I don't think that Tsune has any pressure from above to play certain players like Miura might have at Vissel Kobe, possibly. So it's down to the man who's coach, the man who's the manager, has got to make a team out of these, let's face it, very talented players. And Usami is actually looking very good, playing quite deep and quite wide. At times he was picking up the ball in the left-back position and creating things. So I'm quite pleased. I was interested to see Yamamoto, Iriguchi and Yajima all start together. In basically, those three are all the single volante players for me, the single defensive midfield player that Gamba used to play with so much. And all three of them started, so I'm not sure that two of them are in the right position either. So, plenty to talk about at Gambit, plenty to think about. And yes, you are dead right, complicated things. But I think Sune will work it out and Gamba will come good. And, of course, they also have the ACL to think about.
Yeah, just to complicate things a little bit further, Alan. All right, well, so to events on the pitch, and obviously a derby can be a cagey affair, but this one... Well, it did definitely got off to a rip-roaring start. The first 15 minutes, both teams had the ball in the net, but both goals were correctly disallowed for offside. Yoshida Okubo in the fifth minute put the ball in past Masaaki Higashiguchi, but he was offside and he might have even handled Tatsuhiro Sakamoto's ball over the top before he scored. And in the 14th minute, Alan's mentioned Shin Yajima started. He headed in after Yosuke Itaguchi bundled a corner towards him, but yes, he was offside. In between those two disallowed goals, Higashiguchi had made a brilliant save to deny Okubo's volley at the back post, and then Higashiguchi also parried a Hiroshi Kiyotake volley from inside the D. After 18 minutes, Okubo pulled up with a hamstring injury and he was replaced by Adam Taggart, the Australian striker who was on for his Cerezo debut. And more chances at either end before the halftime break. A Yajima shot was saved by Kim Jin-hyun, and then Naoki Fujita's shot was saved by Higashiguchi. And so with 3 minutes to go before half time, a Yuta Toyokawa cross hit Yuya Fukuda on the arm. And listeners, you know what that means. It's time for This Week in VAR. This Week in VAR. This Week. Well, this was one of those, Sam, I think, where if you're on the opposition side, you'd like to see the defender given the benefit of the doubt here. And certainly in recent times, I think referees and VARs have been a bit more lenient with handballs. In this occasion, what did you think? Was Fukuda harshly done to, or was the correct decision made after that VAR review?
This is a really difficult one because his hand is out. So if you go by the silhouette thing, it's hitting with his hand in an unnatural position. So looking at the face of it, it looks like a handball. But when he goes over to the monitor, he just watches it from the same angle, the same speed every time. And I think, I'm not 100% sure on this, but I've slowed it down frame by frame. And I think it flicks Fukuda's chest first before it goes on to hit his hand. And if that's the case, then it can't be given as handball, as we said with a Tokyo free kick a couple of weeks ago, whereas the a deflection into close quarters, then it's not given. So, but he didn't really check for that, so it's hard to determine that. He probably needed to slow it down, look at a different angle to try and get that, so maybe he didn't have that. So from what he's seen at full speed, I understand why the decision's been given, but I do think Fukuda's been treated quite harshly.
All right, so Alan, you're the only qualified referee on this episode of J Talk, so we better get your thoughts on this, and whether we want to go a bit broader and get your thoughts on, you know, the first 10-12 weeks of VAR in J1. We'd probably be here for quite a while if we were to press you on your thoughts in that much detail. But yeah, on this occasion, again, as Sam said, yeah, we've seen different interpretations of the handball law throughout the season so far, I think. And yeah, whether the referee and the VAR have checked this as thoroughly as they should have, and whether Fukuda has been harshly done to or not, I guess it remains up for debate. But yeah, which way did you see it?
I think you hit the nail on the head with the use of the word interpretations there, because the law states quite clearly what it is, and there is no room for interpretation. And we are still seeing interpretation. As Sam said, it did seem to come off another part of Fukuda's body onto his arm, which in that case, according to the law, is not handball. Before the current law, I would not have given that kind of thing, and most people would have given it because they seem to give everything that hits the hand in the area. But to me, it's not intentional, it's accidental, so the old handball law definitely should not be giving that kind of thing, but they still did. But now the current law states quite clearly that if it comes off another part of the body and hits the player on the hand or the arm, that it's not handball. I probably didn't look at it as closely as Sam, so I'm going to trust him in saying that. But if it did hit any part of his body, it's not handball. And as Sam said, the referee didn't seem to look at it. Maybe they were in a hurry. I mean, it'd taken a while to get back to it. I actually had time to tweet badly, slowly, that looks like a handball to me, and that looks like it's going to go to VAR. I wonder if it will. And, you know, the play was still going on. And I even suggested then that if for example, Cerezo had scored, do they still go back to give the penalty? Because if certain other things happen, and then the ball goes out of play, then they go back and give it. Whatever happened after the handball and the penalty is not in the statistics, for want of a better word. So I was actually thinking to myself, before it was given, now what happens if they score? Or what happens if this happens? And sure enough, they did go back to it. And sure enough, when I looked at it, I thought, no, it's not actually handball. And then they gave it anyway. So I've seen the odd looks at when people tweet about things happening in the rest of the world, and I see VAR things going on. I think that Japan has not quite got it as bad as other parts of the world, probably because we also don't persecute the referees as much as they do in other parts of the world. But yeah, it's still interesting. There are still, as you said, interpretations out there, and there shouldn't be. So I'm with Sam. If it touched the body, it's not a handball. It's not a penalty. And as Sam said on his Twitter, justice was done.
Yes, most definitely. Well, yeah, 3 minutes after the initial incident, Toyokawa himself stood over his penalty and smashed the ball against Higashiguchi's right-hand post, the ball flying across the face of goal and away to safety from a Gumba perspective anyway. So, yeah, justice was done, perhaps, if Fukuda was hard done to. And then, well, Sam, so from that incident, which obviously happened right at the end of the first half, the DAZN highlights skip forward to Cerezo taking the lead in the 74th minute. So am I to read this correctly, that basically not a lot happened, in at least in terms of goalmouth action, for the first half hour of the second half before Motohiko Nakajima put Cerezo ahead?
Like, generally, I don't think it was a bad game necessarily at the start of the second half, but there's not necessarily something that they can pull out for a highlight. There's no saves or anything like that, but it was a keenly contested but if slightly scrappy start to the second half, where I don't think either team really got on top, neither team really controlled possession well enough. And yeah, I don't blame the people putting the highlights together for not taking anything out of that 30 minutes.
All right, well, yeah.
It was definitely a quiet one, yeah. I mean, as you said, nothing really happened compared to the first half. What I'd like to mention that you might not have caught there, Ben, is that Adam Taggart, who came on in the 23rd minute, then left the field in the 63rd minute. I think it was 63, for Nakajima. Nakajima and Kato came on for Sakamoto, and Adam Taggart, who only got 40 minutes. He didn't look too upset as he left the field, and perhaps he needs time to get fit again. And also, I presume he wasn't expecting to come on so early in the game. But I would have thought that it would have been nice to give the guy at least the full game and not embarrass him, for want of a better word, and take him off after 40 minutes after coming on as a sub. But no, he didn't seem to be happy. He was interviewed after the game and he seemed to be happy with his performance. So we've been waiting for him for a long time, so I'm looking forward to seeing what he can do.
He was one of three debutants, actually, for Cerezo in this game. What did you make of Thiago and Dankler's centre-back partnership coming in for Seko and Nishio and Shindo? It all played quite well. So, yeah, what did you make of the Brazilian pairing?
Well, before the game, and I saw that, I thought that's pretty harsh on Nishio, who was dropped to the bench, and Seko, who allegedly is suffering from COVID and hasn't played for at least 3 weeks now. And I was thinking that Dankler and Thiago would probably have to fight for their position because those boys were doing so well. And the fact that their manager does like to play young players. I mean, witness the forwards that he's bringing on, Nakajima and Kato among them. So I was thinking that they might not get in so easily, especially as Dankler has been around a lot longer than Thiago's, I think. So I was wondering if he was ever going to get in. And then suddenly we've got both of them. But they looked quite solid. I don't think any complaints. There was one last-ditch tackle by Dankler, I think it was, early in the first half that probably saved at least a chance, but possibly a goal as well. So I think Nishio and Seko might be hard done by and be losing their places in the near future.
All right, then. So, yeah, we mentioned that Taggart was on as a sub and then subbed off for just after the hour. In the 75th minute, trailing, obviously, 1-0 straight after Nakajima's goal, Miyamoto made three changes himself. One of those was to bring Patrick in place of Leandro Pereira. And in the 80th minute, so just 5 minutes, 82nd minute rather, Patrick converted a penalty to equalise for Gumba. And listeners, you might have caught the fact that we didn't play the outro to this week in VAR. Well, that is because we also need to discuss this penalty incident, again, controversial. And Sam, was this just a case of they paid the first one, so they had to pay the second? Because this is a blast from literally a yard away from the defender, who is has got no idea what's coming at him. And if the ball hits him on the arm, well, it hits him on the arm. But from that far away, surely he can't do anything at all to get out of the way of it.
Well, I agree. I don't think he can do anything. And I think 2 years ago, this is never given because, yeah, what can he do? But I think just the way that the law is and now it's just quite set. So if the hand is outside of the silhouette and it hits it, they give a penalty. It's kind of what they did in the Premier League right at the start when they brought this rule in, where everything was given. It's now been made more lenient. But this is like one of those at the start. It would always be given. It's so harsh. I don't like it at all. But the referee is just following the rules and the laws, and yeah, hands outside the silhouette. It doesn't matter if he's got any intent to block it or not, which he doesn't. They have to give the penalty. I don't like it, but I understand why it was given.
And Alan, that's so the letter of the law was followed here. So this is the correct decision.
Yeah. Again, as Sam said, I wouldn't have given it myself, referee, last year or 2 years ago, but the law is the law now, and it was, the hand was away from the body, and it's a penalty kick. So, yeah, complaints from us, but no complaints from the referee, really, you know, because he's just doing as he's told.
All right, then. Well, yeah, it just doesn't sit right, does it? But, yeah, I guess both teams have benefited from, controversial penalty decisions. Of course, Cerezo didn't stick theirs away, but Gumba did through Patrick, and, yes, that earned them a point away at Cerezo on Sunday then. So, the situation is, basically the same, Alan, at Gumba after this. Now they've played 8 games, obviously with a number of games in hand on the teams above them and indeed below them, but it's now just 2 goals from 8 games and indeed only 1 from open play, the Takashi Usami winner against Sagan Tosu in Gumba's only victory of the season so far. And we asked you earlier on and you sounded confident that sooner or later things will turn around. There's Miyamoto's obviously still shuffling his deck and trying to find his best 11. How long that will take him to finally work that out and get a consistent run of games together from said best 11, we'll wait and see. So I guess there would be a segment of the Gumba support who are almost getting ready to start pulling their hair out at the start to the season they've had. But your advice to them would just be to stick the course and have faith in the manager, because you believe he's the right man to turn it around?
I think so. I mean, there's always going to be people who are upset with what's going on the pitch, especially if teams are not winning and teams are not scoring in this case. I think the Gamba fans in particular can go back to 2005 when Nishino won the championship, and he'd taken years to create a team that actually won something and then went on to win the ACL as well. So if patience is had, can I say they're too good to go down? That would definitely put the cat among the pigeons, wouldn't it? But I'm very confident that they have the players and they have the manager, the intelligence, I think it would be, I'll put the cat among the pigeons again and say that apart from the COVID problem, I think that Gamba are missing the J3 team, the under-23 team, which I think was an unpopular opinion, I suppose, but it was a huge benefit to Gamba. And to Cerezo, and perhaps to FC Tokyo, but you can talk about that if you want. So the fact is that there's a huge squad not many players left. So Wear Gamba had two teams last year and for the last few years, and all the kids got time and played and burst into the team and were ready to come into the team if needed. These days, apart from the fact that Gamba didn't play for a month anyway, there is no under 23 team to help keep those guys fit either. So there's big changes at Gamba. So I think, in a nutshell, patience. And I think that Miyamoto will be given time, and they do have patience. So, and the fact maybe that there are few or no fans, and the fans that are there or will be there are not allowed to shout, it actually might help the team settle.
I've no idea if you'll know the answer to this, Alan, but do you know if Gamba were invited to this J-League satellite league that's been set up this season, a kind of reserve league? I think teams like Urawa and Shimizu were involved. Do you think Gamba would have taken the opportunity if it was available?
Yes, I think I spoke to someone at Gamba and Vissel this time last year. In fact, it was Morista, the manager of the under-23 team, who told me that there will be a league this year and that the teams would go for it. I haven't actually looked. Are they not in it? Or perhaps because of the COVID thing, they actually couldn't go in it? But this time last year, I was asking what Hamatanami, also, who's a Gamba legend and is now the general manager, for want of a better word, I'm not sure. But I spoke to two or three guys at Gamba last season about what they're going to do without the under-23 team. And they were quite confident that there would be games for the players. And I think it's a regional thing, and that all the not necessarily under-23, but reserves now, of course. But definitely, if they are allowed to go in it, or if they've been invited, I'm sure they will take the opportunity, because they've got such a large squad, and it would be irresponsible and not sensible at all to not take it for me.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, so I should have added at the start that, both of these games that we've talked about with Alan at the start of the episode were played before empty stands at the Noriview Stadium in Kobe and the Yanmar Stadium in Osaka, as both the Hyogo Prefecture and Osaka Prefecture are, two of the four under a state of emergency again over the Golden Week period, and an extended period around the Golden Week, and there was no supporters in attendance at either of these games. Before we let Alan go, there is another game that we want to touch on very quickly. And again, listeners, you will have noticed that we didn't play the outro to this week in VAR because we wanted to get Alan's thoughts. I don't know if Alan can go any way towards explaining this incident that was completely VAR'd up up the wall at the Lemon Gas Stadium in Hiratsuka when the Shonan hosted Sapporo. This game was played in front of supporters. Kanagawa is obviously on the border of Tokyo and quite a large prefecture in itself with a number of COVID cases, but they have not gone into state of emergency over the Golden Week holiday. So there were supporters in at the Lemon Gas Stadium and indeed other grounds in Kanagawa over the weekend. So, not to disappoint supporters of either of these teams, Alan, but not a massive amount happened in this game. It was 0-0 heading into second half stoppage time before the Shonan captain Itakuya Okamoto scored what appeared to be a perfectly legitimate winner to send his teammates into raptures and the supporters in the stadium into jubilation, only for the linesman to raise his flag, seemingly in error to all of us who saw the replays, but after a VAR review, the initial decision of offside stood. So do you have any possible explanation for why that would have been the case, as it did appear that Okamoto was clearly onside?
No, good night. I had a look. It's Monday as we record this, of course, so I should have checked if the Zone have actually highlighted this or if they've, on the J-League judgment replay thing, whatever it is. Because it'd be interesting if they do and if they can explain it, because in certain cases there may have been something. But to be honest, I just couldn't work it out. There are times where if a defender makes the challenge and tries to get the ball or it comes off his knee or something, then the player is played onside, which then explains why a goal that we think is offside is given as onside. But this one was so obviously onside, and the TV replays showed clearly that it was onside. And then I looked at the other player who was there. Perhaps he was interfering, but he was onside as well. So in a nutshell, no, I have no idea why that was disallowed.
Yeah, it's a real head-scratcher, isn't it, Sam? The incident comes after the ball's played into the box on a couple of different occasions, and I might have, well, it's not an explanation that I have any confidence in, but I think it's probably the third time the ball's played in the box, isn't it, that Wellington heads it on for Okamoto to score. I think maybe the first time or... The first time it's recycled back into the box, I think a forward is standing in an offside position when a defender heads it away. So it's possible maybe that the linesman who's on the other side to this incident thought maybe that that forward was closer to the defender than he actually was, and that he might have been trying to play the ball even though he didn't jump for it. So in these times of delayed offsides, I'm not sure whether it might have been that, but that is my only possible explanation, because on the actual goal scene itself, where Wellington heads on for Okamoto, he is clearly onside, isn't he?
Well, I think so. Seemingly everyone except for the linesman and the video assistant referee thinks he is. You might be right with that, because as you say, with the delayed flag, they have to wait until it's all played out before giving the flag. The only other one I can think of, and it's been mentioned a few times on Twitter that I've seen, is Okamoto's arm is out and his sleeve is very close to where the last defender is. And we've seen it in England, and it's the most frustrating thing you can ever imagine, where the sleeve is where they take the line as they draw it down, and they class that as offside. There was one, it was a Leeds game, the striker was pointing to where he wants the ball, and because he was pointing, he got himself caught offside, even though his feet were about a yard onside. So that is the only thing I can think of, that behind the scenes they have checked it like that, and it looks like the sleeve is in an offside position, because to anyone looking at that, it's onside, and I just don't know how I could sit there if I was one of these video referees and be quite comfortable in giving that offside. It looks baffling to me, and it might just be a case where we've seen before that they don't want to go against the on-field decision, they don't want to make them look foolish or whatnot, don't want to question that, but to me, I just cannot accept that this is offside.
Well, yeah, it's an interesting point by Sam, isn't it, Alan? And we've spoken about it a number of times over the years with the media, obviously not wanting to criticise, and under instruction not to criticise match officials. We wondered whether that would obviously seep through to VAR and, video assistant referees not wanting to overrule their colleagues who are, actually in the stadium, and whether this is an incident that is indeed the case. I guess we'll never know, but yeah, it's certainly a very difficult one for Seanan to take. And again, apologies to Seanan supporters. It seems whenever you're this high in our running order on JTOG, it's for controversial reasons. Maybe the ghost goal against Reds a couple of years ago was maybe the only other time in the last couple of years you've been this high in our running order. And unfortunately for your guys, again, it's in hugely controversial circumstances where you've been denied what appears to be an obvious goal. So, I guess we've seen, we've said all we can about those incidents. We can't comprehend it, but we hope that the referee and the linesman and the VAR can sleep at night after denying Sean under 3 points at the death. So that was this week in VAR. This week in VAR. This week. And with that, Alan, it's just about time to let you go. Thanks again for your thoughts on all things Kansai in J1. But yeah, before we let you out the door, what's happening behind the scenes at J Soccer Towers?
Well, as we said last time, or was it 3 or 4 weeks ago, there's another J Soccer magazine in the works. Ideally, some nice interviews. The website is coming along nicely. I mentioned that there's a very ambitious project going on the website to to try to list and even interview every single player that has ever played in J-League. So obviously that's not going to be done in the next couple of weeks. But yeah, basically follow me on Twitter at JSoccer Magazine, and I'll keep you in touch with everything that's going on. Also, for those who don't know, I supply J-League shirts, for want of a better word, and a lot of people have been asking about them recently, so I put a little thread up on there about people trying to get J-League shirts. So follow at J-League shirts if you can, and it's not really a business because I barely make any money on it, but I do help people get shirts around the world, and it's been quite nice to get pictures of people and thanks from people who are now wearing Kyoto Sanga shirts in Scotland and Sagantosu shirts in Florida. It's really cool. So, yeah, J-League shirts and J-Soccer Magazine, and just keep in touch on Twitter. Ask me anything, anytime. Thank you very much.
All right, yeah, one of the busiest men in Japanese football, no question about that. Always great to get Alan's thoughts, as I said earlier. So, mate, look forward to catching up with you again as the season progresses.
Thank you very much, and the pleasure was all yours.
As always. All right, so after a quick hit of music, Sam and I will be back to round up the rest of the J1 Match Day 12 action. Welcome back, and next to the team that began the match day in third, of course, Sagantosu were sitting pretty, having won three of their past four, including impressive 2-1 wins away at Nagoya and FC Tokyo in their past two games. They welcomed Tokushima, who had lost two straight since the arrival of manager Danny Poyatos, and unfortunately for Poyatos, yes, he's still yet to see his side let alone take a point, a win in the league after a 2-0 home win for Tosu. Sam, both of these goals came in the second half, somewhat fortunate the second one, but the first one was another example of Tosu's fierce press in the 55th minute, winning the ball back in midfield. And, Keita Yamashita's goal deflected in off a defender, which was a bit unfortunate on Tokushima. But you could see Tosu's press in action again and, sending them forward rapidly from midfield.
Yeah, it's kind of a classic way that they're scoring their goals at the moment, isn't it? Really good. They don't give any team a time on the ball, and Tokushima are the sort of team that they'd want to play, because Tokushima will play out from the back, try and take their time, and Tosu was straight on them. And Keita Yamashita, I mean, he doesn't start every game, but he seems to score pretty much every time. And he deserved his luck, I thought, got a little bit of luck with the deflection, but yeah, he's got in the right place, and it sent Tosu on their way. I thought they were, again, the better side, and Tokushima, Poyatos should probably get back onto Zoom and give up picking up this team, because I just disagree completely with a lot of what he did in this game. I think their three best players, besides Iwao, the captain, are Watai, Kakita and Nishia, and none of them started. I didn't really understand the logic behind that, and they were quite comfortably beaten, I thought.
Yeah, really interesting, isn't it? I was going to ask you whether you thought they'd been doing anything differently since Poyatos came in. Well, obviously, whether they're rested or dropped, getting rid of three of your better players is, not probably the smartest of ideas, but maybe there is method in Poyatos's madness that will pay off down the road. We'll wait and see. So that was 10 minutes into the second half, Tosu taking the lead, and then with 15 minutes to go, again, as I said earlier, some fortune in their second goal. A corner was deflected by a Tokushima defender to Keiya Sento. He volleyed against the keeper, Naoto Kami Fukumoto, and then the rebound hit his leg and went in, which he knew very little about, but obviously very happy to wheel away and celebrate was a Sento, and that wrapped up the 3 points for Tosu, and kept them up in third spot in the table, and it sounded like another good win here on merit for the Kyushu side. Next two events head to Ajinomoto Stadium on Saturday when FC Tokyo hosted Yokohama F. Marinos. This fixture had produced lots of goals in recent years. Tokyo had won it 5-2 in 2018 and 4-2 the following season before F. Marinos exacted their revenge with a 4-0 battering of the Gasmen last season. And, this edition of this this game was, not much better from an FC Tokyo perspective. F. Marinos running out the 3-0 winners. A hat-trick for Ado Onaiwu, grabbed the headlines, but basically he will never score three easier goals in his life, will he, Sam? Basically all the plaudits here have to go to the Brazilian forward Elba, who set up all three goals. But, from an FC Tokyo perspective, this was an absolute horror show with a number of, interestingly enough, players in milestone occasions, in particular Ryoya Ogawa, culpable here. This was just an absolute horror show from an FC Tokyo perspective.
Oh, it was just dreadful. I mean, Elbert plays very well, I think, and he takes advantage of the space and the pretty tame defending that he was up against on Onaiwu. I mean, he scores three tap-ins, but you could argue his movement is pretty decent. But really, as well as Yokohama played, they've come up against a Tokyo defence and midfield that was just offering them so much space. The first goal is a complete embarrassment, I think. Ogawa, as you mentioned, is there up in midfield. He tries to make a tackle. He completely gets nowhere near it. He's left himself completely out of position. It drags everyone else across to try and get Elbert, but no one really gets close to him. The midfield don't react. I mean, Higashi is the one I'm pointing at here. He doesn't jog back at all. He's just waiting there. And it gets to a point where everyone's been dragged over, and you leave Onaiwu and Maeda completely free at the back post. They're just queuing up to tap it in. And there were time and time again where the players just not really jogging, not really getting back. They were just jogging. Ogawa, I thought, was the main culprit, but Umari as well. Hasukawa came in at right back very early on for Uchida. And I know he's not a right back and it's his first season, but really he wasn't putting in the effort. And the midfield, once you take Morishige out of it, it's just absent. And there was the time, for the third goal, I think it is, where Morishige is back in centre-back. The midfield has disappeared, so Morishige steps out to try and do something, but he's left Watanabe in behind. The rest of the midfield and defence are not paying attention, and it's so easy for Yokohama to work their way through it. So, yeah, it was just a really embarrassing performance, and I can't imagine how you're feeling as an FC Tokyo supporter.
Our patrons who are members of our line group certainly got my thoughts on Saturday evening after I was able to watch the game. I didn't catch it live, but watched the replay in full without knowing the score. And I struggle to speak cohesively on here about FC Tokyo, if we're doing well or if we're doing poorly. But yeah, in recent weeks, it's just been an absolute horror show. And it's Ogawa's 100th J1 game, and he could hardly have played a worse one. He's certainly a whipping boy for a number of Tokyo supporters, but yeah, this was just absolutely abject from him. As you say, the first goal, he just completely goes walkabout and leaves the entire rest of his defence completely stranded. Omari's never going to be able to keep up with Elbert, who is able to race around him. And, I mean, Onaiwa gets the ball stuck under his feet twice, doesn't he, before he's actually able to poke it in. I mean, there is just so much time for him to score the first goal. The second one is, for me, that's just an utter embarrassment for Ogawa. I mean, it's one of the weakest things that you will ever see on a football pitch, and it's just completely spineless to just let a player bump off you and just completely run around you and not even put in a challenge. I mean, take a yellow card for the team here. I mean, come on, man. You're just absolutely weak as water. And, Elba's just squared across for Onaiwu to tap in his second. Then, the third one, as you say, Tokyo was stretched. They're all over the shop, and Elba's shot was saved by Gol Hatano. Onaiwu had time to take a touch and fire in from 6 yards. Tokyo had a couple of chances at 1-0, and you never know what would have happened. But, yeah, Ogawa's free kick went wide, and Higashi volleyed straight at the keeper. We should say it was Higashi's 300th game, I believe 300th J1 game. And, the club went straight into overdrive, at least the merchandise department did. And if you thought that J1 and Japanese teams had got everything that they could possibly sell online in terms of commemorative goods, well, Tokyo have gone the final step here, perhaps, and put commemorative Keigo Higashi coat hangers on sale. So, I'm sure they've gone like hotcakes amongst the Tokyo support. I'm at my wit's end here, Sam. This is just absolutely ridiculous. I mean, obviously didn't have high hopes coming into the game. You heard me on last week's episode. If you're going to play like this, and it's just so unlike Tokyo, you know, if we were anything in the past few seasons, it was defensively, reasonably defensively solid, and that's just completely gone to water this year.
Yeah, and I honestly don't want to rub it in at all, but I just thought there's last couple of years at home, especially against Yokohama, against Kawasaki, Tokyo have been on the end of some horrendous performances and results, conceding 3 or 4 goals in pretty much all of those games. Do you put that down to Hasegawa not changing his tactics, not matching up properly against these teams, or do you think there's like a bigger problem in terms of recruitment at the club? It's like, especially your fullback areas, which Ogawa has had that position to himself since Kosuke Ota left, and right back, I mean, there's still been no real replacement for Sei Maruya.
Yeah, I think it's due down to the fact that our squad is not good enough, and and we can be exposed and we can be caught out, and teams will target certain areas and they know where our soft spot is, our weak point is, and they're able to exploit it again and again to devastating effect. I mean, as we saw here on Saturday. But yeah, I mean, I'm starting to wonder whether this whole Leandro thing has really seeped into the morale of the squad, Sam. I don't know whether we'll ever find out, as we said, what was really behind this, and if it actually is affecting morale. But it just seems that the performances have been so flat in recent weeks, and whether Hasegawa is beginning to lose the dressing room, whether he's actually has lost it, I don't know. But, obviously 3 months, 4 months removed from winning the Levain Cup, I mean, the side just look as flat as attack. And, to get back to your question, in terms of big games like this, yeah, I mean, he has to take the responsibility here because, I mean, yeah, Hasegawa was drawn into action here after Uchida basically snapped his arm in half, didn't he? But, I mean, yeah, the fact that Uchida was starting at fullback in a game like this is, I think it's an indictment on our squad as well. I mean, we've gone into, big games like these, and we've just looked undercooked, and we've just looked not ready, and, you know, the most recent Kawasaki game, they were just devastating, weren't they? And they would have taken, I think, any team apart. But these two teams in particular, they do appear to enjoy travelling to Ajinomoto Stadium and teaching us a lesson. But I don't have the answers, and I warned you before we started. Yeah, you wouldn't get a very cohesive answer out of me. But this is it seems to be going from bad to worse, and the manager definitely has to take his share of the blame. But the players themselves as well, for as you said yourself, seemingly a lack of effort. I mean, I hate to say that myself, like you're suggesting that a professional isn't trying at his job, but I mean, it does appear at times that the Tokyo players just completely they've lost their motivation and their drive to get anything out of these games. And it was telling, I think, to see Hasegawa in tears at the full-time whistle. I mean, this first-year player who was brought on into this game in the second or third minute and has, he hasn't set the world on fire, but he's done okay and he's worked his socks off, and at the end of the 90 minutes with his team soundly beaten. And, I mean, he knew the last half hour of this game that Tokyo weren't getting anything from it, but at the full-time whistle, he broke down and he really felt the sting of this defeat. But it looked like he was the only one. There didn't really appear to be too many bowed heads from the Tokyo players, even though they'd put in collectively a pretty abject performance. So Again, same as last week, I didn't want to take away from Tosu, and I don't want to take away from F. Marinos, but yeah, Tokyo, this was dreadful. Graham Frecce did have a question for us about Tokyo, Sam, but I think I've spoken for long enough and tied myself in knots enough that we can move on, and Graham Frecce will hopefully understand. On the victors on the afternoon, F. Marinos, we had a question from one of our newest patrons, Daniel. With their games in hand, are F. Marinos now the most likely challengers to Frontale this season? Of course, that comes, Daniel's question comes after F. Marinos have beaten Tokyo on Saturday, and of course Nagoya were swatted aside by Kawasaki last Thursday.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely put themselves in the position for it. I would argue I don't think there's anyone that's a close competitor of Kawasaki. I just think they're that good and they're that far away from one. And I wouldn't be ruling out Nagoya at this stage. They got soundly beaten by Kawasaki, but then so did Yokohama and so do most teams that go against them. So I think it's between those two as probably the main challenges, although Tosu are still playing very well. But I'm not going to get carried away with Yokohama. I've said it for a couple of weeks now. The last three games, yes, they've won very well, but they've been against Sapporo, who are notably a really weakened inviting defence to play against Yokohama FC last week, which were embarrassing, and then FC Tokyo as well were very accommodating to them. So they've got games coming up. I think it's Kobe at the weekend, and I think if they get a bit more of a challenge in those sorts of games, that's when we'll see where this Yokohama team are, because as I'll keep coming back to, when they played against solid defences against Shonan and Sendai that just sat in, they didn't break them down. So they've got those hurdles to overcome. But yeah, in terms of the way they're playing in recent games, yeah, you'll have to consider them close contenders. You'd say they'd be... And I'd say they'd be an ACL contender, at least. No, I'd say they'd finish in the top three this season, but I still think they're a way away from challenging Kawasaki properly.
Yeah, they're definitely going to take some catching, aren't they, Frontale? But yeah, F. Marinos did what they had to do on Saturday. They took, as Sam said, they took advantage of a very accommodating host, and a comfortable 3-0 win to keep them fourth in the table. All right, well, Daniel and Graham Frecce got in touch with us via Patreon. I should apologise to our other patrons that I didn't send out a request for questions on Monday morning, as I usually do. You can put that down to, as we said at the start of the episode, a busier than normal schedule for me with Golden Week going on and actually being off work, meaning I have less time to prepare for the podcast. So apologies for that and not getting the call for questions in. But yeah, thanks to Daniel and Graham Frecce for getting their questions sent along. Regardless, and Daniel will be a very happy man again after this weekend's action, Sam, with his Avispa Fukuoka side winning again for the third straight game and heading up the table to seventh. This was the game that both Johnny and myself were looking forward to on last week's episode, and at least from a Fukuoka perspective, Sam, it did not disappoint, with an early goal for Bruno Mendes and a late one, a first J-League goal for John Mary. But this was a personal horror show, wasn't it, for veteran Urawa keeper Shusaku Nishikawa?
Yeah, you and Johnny might have been looking forward to it, but Nishikawa will never want to see it back again. He had an absolute horror show. Really, I mean, he had a period of, say, maybe 3 years ago where he was making a few errors quite consistently, but generally got a bit better in the last few years. But this was back to his absolute worst. I mean, the first goal, there's no excuse for him to drop it. There's a hint of contact with Akimoto, but really it just pops it up as if it's a hot potato and drops it to Bruno Mendes. And then John Mary will be delighted to have got a goal like this. I mean, it's a very fierce strike, but it's straight at Nishikawa. He gets two hands to it, and I have no idea how he allows it to go past him. So yeah, really poor from Nishikawa. I mean, the game was tight otherwise, and I'd say on the balance of play it would have been fair as a draw. But yeah, those two moments of cost Urawa and cost Nishikawa, and young Suzuki has been performing quite well in the Levain Cup, and any more performances like that from Nishikawa and he might be in danger of losing his place.
Well, yes, there was rumblings in the Patreon only line group about whether it was time for Suzuki to come in for Reds between the sticks. So yeah, well, basically, Sam, again, this game on the highlights is these two incidences and these two mistakes from Nishikawa, who, as you say, he has in recent times at least been. Dependable, I'm not sure is really the right word, but he's capable of making some terrific saves and has obviously kept Reds in a number of games and in a number of winning positions. I mean, you can even think back to last week, can't you? The win against Oita, he preserved that with three big saves in stoppage time. But then, yeah, to make two absolute clangers here is that will have just been hugely frustrating to of course firstly to himself, to his coach Ricardo Rodriguez, and then to all Reds fans who would have been looking forward to this game an immense amount, I'm sure. And it's just a real shame for them that it's been spoiled by these two mistakes from Nishikawa. But so Fukuoka then, I mean, they've surprised us all at the start of the season. Well, most of us, obviously, we thought they would be at least bottom half, whether they'd be involved in the relegation dogfight or not. But to be up in seventh, and I guess, well, yeah, you've got to be in the right place at the right time to take advantage of mistakes like these from Nishikawa. Bruno Mendes obviously loves scoring a goal more than just about anybody you'll ever see, and the way he wheels away after scoring is always great to see. And yeah, his sheer delight here for the first was terrific. And then yeah, John Mary celebrating his first J League goal with a very acrobatic celebration that was absolutely fantastic to see. So as you said, a fairly even game that was probably a draw on the balance of play. But, yeah, again, these Fukuoka are just the beneficiary, and I guess you've got to take your chances when they present themselves, don't you?
Yeah, you do. I mean, they were very, very nicely presented, especially the Bruno Mendes one. But, yeah, they played reasonably well. I'd say they played a lot better in previous games this season, but maybe not got the rewards in some of them. But, yeah, they had a few chances. They were toe-to-toe with Urara, who were in fairly decent form coming into the game, and... Yeah, they did take the chances. I don't think it was the greatest performance, to be fair, actually. They just got a little bit lucky. But defensively, they're very solid. Urawa had a lot of possession as they're going to, the way that they want to play, but really didn't test Murakami too much, and that is down to the way that Avispa have defended. It's the way they've been defending all season. Their back line is almost as good as any, to be honest. Grolli, Salomonson, Nara, even Shichi to an extent, although I don't think he's quite as good as the others. But yeah, it was a very compact performance from Avispa, and they've taken their chances to come away with a 2-0 win. Urawa, I thought, while they had a lot of the ball, I said last week that they kind of tinkered with their formation. They brought in Sugimoto last time. This week they brought in Kuroki, which sounds like a good idea on paper, but again it is shifting the balance of the team around, where Muto goes back and Koizumi this time was shoved out to a wing and not in his best position where he's been playing so well behind the striker, and Akimoto was at left back. So it's just, I think he's tinkering a little bit too much, and it didn't really make sense to me. I agree. I know that Muto's been playing quite well, but if you want to bring Kuroki in, I think he just had to drop Muto and keep everything the same. But yeah, his tinkering, it's just not really getting the desired results, and it's kind of taken them a couple of steps backwards from when they were playing very well and getting those wins a few weeks ago.
Yeah, all right then. Well, yeah, the good times continue to roll for Fukuoka, as we said, a third straight win and a seventh in the table. Reds still top half. That's actually their second loss in their past three games. But, they're comfortably mid-table. And with three games to go, Sam, they were all contested by teams in the bottom half of the table. Well, I say that. Well, Kashima are now up to 10th, so they're technically a top half, the 10th and a final team in the top half of the table after they travelled to bottom club Yokohama FC on Saturday and returned back up to Ibaraki with all 3 points after a 3-0 victory. They got on the score sheet in the 12th minute when Ryotaro Araki's shot was blocked and Ryohei Shirasaki leapt to head in the loose ball after a Tashiro foul on Araki in first half stoppage time. Shoma Doi saw his penalty tipped onto the post by Yuji Rokutan, but then Doi recovered to stab in the rebound. Then with the 10 minutes left, Koki Machida powered in a header from a corner, and that was that. And this looks particularly cut and dried, Sam. Was there anything else major to report from this game? It looked very, very comfortable for Antlers.
It was very comfortable. As soon as the first goal went in, it was a bit of a procession from then on. Yokohama had started okay. They were contending at least. But yeah, once that first goal goes in, that was pretty much it. Yokohama, I mean, they dropped Hakamada finally after his performance, let's say, last week. But that didn't, well, they replaced by Tashiro and then committed the foul for the penalty. So maybe that wasn't worth it. And they went with the very interesting ploy of dropping your best player as Matsuo was starting on the bench. So, okay, do whatever they like, Yokohama. And this was embarrassing. As again, defensively, they lost 3-0 to a team that had no Everaldo, no Ueda. They were starting Yuta Someno in attack with Shoma Doi and Shirasaki. It was not the strongest Kashima team that they're going to put out, but they strolled to victory. And yeah, it was just another horrible day for Yokohama FC and their supporters.
Yes, yeah, so you mentioned Noah Everaldo there. Of course, he hasn't scored so far this season, Sam, and there we don't want to cast aspersions, but there's rumours that both he and Juan Alano are out due to the virus. So that would, I guess that would be the most likely explanation for why they haven't featured in recent times.
Well, yeah, they have two players out, and they're the only two players that haven't featured since that, so I think it's a fair enough
right.
Yeah, I know that Juan Alano at least is back in training, so he's okay. But Everaldo, they're hoping he's back this week. But yeah, we'll see. We'll see. Hopefully, the all's good with both of them.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, get well soon to the pair of them. Hope to see them back out on the pitch and doing their business sharpish. All right, so we have the final two games left to review. We're both, in some respects, very surprising victories from teams that began the match day in the bottom three. So, yeah, we actually do have a question from Graham Freche that we will get to this time. We promise, Graham Freche, we won't skip over it. But, yeah, we'll let you know what happened on the pitch first, listeners. It was Sendai who hosted Kashiwa, and this was well, it looked on paper, a lay-down misere for visiting Raisol, who had came in on the back of three straight wins. And we mentioned it last week on the podcast, Sam, they had finally clicked into gear for seemingly the first time since the departure of Michael Olunga when they strolled to that 5-1 home win over Tokushima. And they travelled up to Sendai to face Vegalta, who were still looking for their first win of this season and the first in the league at the Yurtec Stadium since late November 2019 in their final home game of the 2019 season. So what happened? Well, of course, this is the J-League. So what happened is, in the 68th minute, Takuma Nishimura headed in a cross from Koji Hachisuka, and Sendai won 1-0.
They did, yeah, very much the J-League. I mean, Kashiwa, they were all guns blazing. You said clicked into gear. Well, they hit into reverse this game. They were terrible. They, as most teams will do against Sendai, they had a lot of the ball, but really didn't create anything. Sendai were pretty comfortable. And if anything, I think they had the better chances in the game and were deserved winners. They actually showed a hint of quality. I mean, Nishimura has not done enough for me since coming back. I mean, he's a player that went to Europe, played for CSKA Moscow, but you'd never know it in the way he's been playing since returning. But yeah, he got the goal. It was a terrific ball in from Hachiska from the right-hand side. Nishimura, I mean, it should be disallowed, which is unfortunate, as it flicks off his arm, and it really should be disallowed. It would be so cruel on Vegalta if you're going to chalk off a first win in, what was it, over 500 days, I think it was. If you chalk that off, the handball would have been so cruel, but it should have been. But I think you have to give it to Vegalta. They worked really hard. When you don't necessarily see the effort also with Yokohama FC, at least in this game, Vegalta did put it in, and yeah, they were the better team, and I thought deserved the victory.
Yeah, I wondered if you were going to go there, Sam. It would have been, yeah, as you say, it would have been hugely cruel to take it away from Sendai, especially after they waited so long for a home win. But yes, as you say, the ball does definitely appear to glance off Nishimura's arm after he heads it down past the Kashiwa keeper. So, by the letter of the law, if we don't even know if obviously VAR had a look at it, or they obviously should have. They should be checking every goal. But it was allowed to stand, and we don't want to rain on any Vigalta supporters' parades. So all we'll do is say, well done on a first home win since November 2019, and indeed a first win of any kind of the new J1 season. It still leaves them in 19th in the table, but now they are they're at least within touching distance of Gunma Osaka, just a point behind them, having played three games more. And speaking of Gunma, Oita moved above Gunma in the table and up to the giddy heights of 17th after a 1-0 home win of their own. They came into this game where they were hosting Shimizu on the back of seven straight defeats after beginning their season unbeaten in their first three. It must be said, though, that Shimizu weren't pulling up any trees themselves. They'd drawn three straight and were without a win in five games. And, Oita, after his brace last week in the loss at Urawa, Yamato Machida was up to his old tricks again, hooking in from a yard out after Yuki Kagawa had deflected a corner towards goal. That was 7 minutes before half-time, and that was enough, Sam, for Oita to run out 1-0 victors themselves.
Yeah, it wasn't the most exciting game, I have to admit, and Machida gets his goal, but he swings at it. It doesn't hit him with his foot. It bounces up. I think it clips his chest, so he has no real idea about it, but he'll take any goal that comes his way. And I just thought Shimizu was so disappointing. Second half, they had all of the ball. Every time you look at the game, it was them in the Oita half. But I think they created maybe two chances, and that was it, and not really anything clear-cut. There was the Nishizawa one into the side netting, but otherwise, they were not threatening at all. They've arguably been the biggest disappointment, for me at least, this season. You looked at the way that the signings they'd brought in, you thought Lottner's a good manager, will get them up into a solid mid-table. And while they don't concede too many, it's not like last season where they find themselves 3-0 down in most games and have to come back, but they've lost any ability, really, seemingly, to go forward. They're just not creative enough. Thiago Santana kind of ploughs a lone furrow up front, so he's not really got the support. And it's probably down to the way that Lottina sets his team up, because we've seen Nishizawa in particular have very good seasons, and it's just not working for him or Nakayama in recent games. And it's another really disappointing performance from Shimizu. But this win for Oita, as well as the Sendai one, it's great for the league, because I think in recent weeks we've kind of been ruling the three teams out, Oita, Sendai and Yokohama. And with these wins, it puts everyone within touching distance again. And we can have a thing to look forward to, a really exciting relegation battle.
Yeah, most definitely. So, Graham Freche asks, on both of these last two games that we've covered, which win was more shocking, Vigalta's or Trinita's? And I guess on the flip side is an interesting point from Graham Freche. How alarming should the games be for the two losing sides, so Kashiwa and Shimizu, respectively?
Well, I think the most shocking one was Sendai, because they've gone so long without a home victory. They've not really looked like winning any game this season. The games they were playing, they'd kind of drawn a few, but didn't really look like winning those games. They got lucky also against Hiroshima. There was the 0-0 draw against Yokohama F. Marinos, where they didn't really leave their own half, and then there was a comeback against the worst team in the league a couple of weeks ago. So, they have to be the most shocking, especially, as we've said, Kashiwa were coming into it off the back of that crushing win over Tokushima the week before. So, that was the most J-League of the results. Oita and Shimizu, the way they both have played this season, you can't really separate them. Both have been fairly disappointing. So I wouldn't say that was too much of a surprise. And on the flip side of that question, I think Shimizu have to be quite worried now, in the way that they just couldn't break down a pretty poor team in Oita. And even with the players they've had, they're still in and around the same position that they were last season. So they've got to be worried. And it's brought Kashiwa down to earth completely after that win last week. I don't think they're relegation fodder, but yeah, it's a really disappointing result for them to lose to Sendai. I mean, it's I don't want to be too cruel on Sendai, but they probably have to consider it a bit of an embarrassment of the way that Sendai have played this season. So hopefully for them, it just kicks them back into gear. But yeah, it was a really disappointing result. And I mean, they're only 5 points off relegation. And Oita have got a game in hand on them. So yeah, they might have to look over their shoulders, but I think there's still enough in that squad, in that side, to stay up.
Fair enough. Well, yeah, they were terrific wins for both Vegalta and Oita, and all that's left to do, Sam, is for us to let the listeners know that obviously that match day 12 concludes on Tuesday. Obviously, it's round two of the clash between the top two, the return leg after the defending champions smashed Krampus 4-0 in the first game last Thursday. Of course, our patrons got to listen to our thoughts on that game in a Patreon-exclusive podcast released the night of. But yeah, we're certainly not making any promises, are we, this midweek with some more Levain Cup games on your slate, Sam. So we'll wait and see, but yeah, not making any promises on that regard. But so that will be the end of match day 12 when the top two face off again, and then match day 13 will be played over the weekend. There's three games on Saturday, and then the other seven are all taking place on Sunday. So it's time for Sam's pick of the weekend. Still got our intern working away feverishly on a jingle for this new segment at the end of the podcast. But so Sam, what's your pick of the match day 13 slate?
Yeah, I've tried to go as safe as possible to avoid this 1-1 curse that I seem to have got. I'm going with the most open game, I think, on paper. Yokohama versus Vissel Kobe on Sunday. Both teams coming off very good 3-0 victories. Both teams, in generally very good form. Both exciting attacking teams. If that ends 0-0, I'll eat my hat. I think it's got to be... yeah. It's got all the makings of a terrific game. So it's a little bit early for people in Europe. It's a 5 a.m. kickoff, but for me, it's perfect. If I want any game to be opening the game, I think opening the round that early, it's Yokohama versus Kobe. So yeah, hopefully that should be a really exciting match.
Yeah, if we were playing Dan Ulowitz's Guess Which Game Sam's Going to Pick a Game, yes, I was expecting you to plump for that one, Sam. And a very mouth-watering-looking game it is indeed. And should be an absolute cracker at the Nissan Stadium. Just out of interest, though, if a listener's only available on Saturday, say, this week, and there's of those three games, all three, they do look somewhat tasty in their own rights. Which one would you plump for? Obviously, they're spaced out, so you could probably catch a couple of them if you're able to, listeners. But yeah, which one would you go for from the three on Saturday?
They've all got their levels of intrigue. The Gamba versus Kawasaki, I think, it's interesting, given that Gamba played quite well in the Super Cup and then have gone really quite poor afterwards. But I'm going to say Nagoya versus Cerezo, actually, just as an intrigue thing. Just Nagoya obviously lost horrendously on Thursday against Kawasaki. They've got to face them again on Tuesday. If it's a very similar result, just how do Nagoya respond to that? Because they've got to try and put those out of their mind and then go again against the Cerezo team that, okay, decent draw here. They've got their new players coming in, getting fresher as they will do. They're playing quite well as well with Sakamoto back. So, yeah, I'd go with Nagoya versus Cerezo, two ACL teams, and it looks a very interesting game, and it will depend, I think, on how Nagoya fare on Tuesday as to, kind of what importance this has on it. Are they going to beat Kawasaki, maybe, and then be right in the title race? Or are they just going to have to stop themselves from slipping further down the table?
It does look intriguing, and that's a very good shout. Yeah, so, but you're right, though. Yeah, all three, they do have their points to consider and, points to recommend them. We certainly hope you're able to check out a number of games over the weekend, listeners. And with that, I think we'll leave it there. Sam, always great to catch up with you as we do, obviously, on a weekly basis and as the season rolls on. And, we'll enjoy the Levain Cup in midweek and we'll be back to do it all again next week.
Thank you. I hope Golden Week can take your mind off FC Tokyo at least for a few days and enjoy some time off and leave me to the Levain Cup.
That sounds reasonable. Yeah. Okay. Thanks very much, mate. All right. Yeah. So we'll leave it there. That is it for this week's episode of the J Talk Podcaster. Sam and I would like to thank Alan Gibson for his time in part one of this week's episode. Obviously, again, we'd like to thank Graham Frecce and Daniel for their questions, and we'd like to thank all of our patrons for their ongoing support on Patreon. Listeners, you know it goes without saying, we'd also like to thank you for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to round up J1 Match Day 13. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J Talk Podcast. Yosh, 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 yosh.